Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to Shop Talk Show. We got a big, awesome episode for you today. But just so I can mention the sponsors at the top of the show, make them happy. We have Environments for Humans who do that In Control conference, and they've just announced their 2013 conference. It's back in Orlando, kind of the home base for it. So that's at 2013.incontrolconference.com. Check it out. I'll be there again. It's going to be lots of fun. And we have lynda.com. So lynda.com/shoptalk. I'm sure you've all heard of them. Tons and tons of training videos for web design stuff, but much more than that, too. And we'll tell you about that a little bit later in the show. But for now, let's kick things off.
Welcome to episode 44 of the Shop Talk Show, a podcast all about front-end web design and development. And today, we have a very big show. You might even say it's a big web show. I'm Dave Rupert. With me is Chris Goyer.
Yeah, and we have Jeffrey Zeldman here today. Huge episode. Thanks for joining us, Jeffrey.
Pleasure. Thanks, Dave. Thanks, Chris.
Yeah, exciting. I was just on Jeffrey's show, literally called the Big Web Show on the 5x5 network. So we'll have links to all that in the show notes if you don't already listen to it. I'm sure that you do, though, because it's fantastic. Jeffrey does a lot. You know, you're on getting near and on 100 shows, probably.
75, 76, something like that. So you're catching up.
Nice. So I would say that he's almost transcend introduction, but you never know these days. Sometimes people, you know, you just never know exactly what people know. All these youngsters running around. Jeffrey is kind of the godfather of web design, has done so many huge, important things for our industry. Websites that I'm sure you've seen, like a listapart.com, an event apart, web conferences all around the U.S., a book apart, publishes little fantastic books about kind of the big topics of the day and web design, founded the Happy Cog Studio, some just huge feathers in your hat. So what does apart mean in the, like, a list apart, event apart? What is that? Where does that come from?
Sure. So back in 1997, I was on mailing lists. Like, that's how we exchange information about web design, right? And email mailing lists, right? And another guy, a guy named Brian, and I wanted to, Brian Platts, I actually complained that there was so much spam on all these lists, and I wish we could have a more curated form of a list. And this guy, Brian, said, well, I could probably help you out. I'm already running a list, and so he was more of a back-end guy. And he was a list meister, and so we called it a list apart, in tribute to a band apart, which is a Godard film, which is what, if you've seen Pulp Fiction or any of the other fine films, they're always a band apart. It's an homage to an homage to an homage. And we just wanted people to know that it was a little bit different. Usually on mailing lists, everyone would, everyone would email, and then everyone would get the emails. And so it was kind of like the Facebook stream is today. And instead what we did, we had everyone send the mail to us, and then we would go through it, Brian or I, taking turns, would go through it and edit it down to about 25 entries and basically present a curated email magazine every
day. That's
how
you prevented spam, because it was only the only things that made it were things that you put there.
When we'd find themes, kind of like you do now, right? You'd sort of, like, there wasn't a blogosphere yet, but we'd find themes like, wow, everyone seems really interested in this new thing called JavaScript, or everybody's really angry about this new thing called JavaScript, or whatever. And so we'd put this, people would be attacking JavaScript, people would be defending JavaScript. We put those two things together, and yeah, so it was a part. And the next year, we made the natural transition to a website because that's what I'd always, you know. There were two design sites at the time. One was High Five, which had been started by David Siegel, the guy who did, the guy who basically popularized table layouts and all this other stuff. And he's a fantastic, but at the time it was fantastic because there was really no way to do design in HTML. And he figured out ways. Lynda.com, Lynda Weinman also was figuring out ways. And so these were two pioneers. And he had, David Siegel put together this site called, he made a book called Creating Killer Websites that was a huge hit. And, I still have my copies of the first and second edition, and he'd made this thing called High Five, which is basically honoring good design on the web. And he found a lot of people, like, you know, a lot of early shops that were doing stuff in Shockwave, or a lot of people like Lance Arthur, you know, pioneers of creative content on the web. And, that was good, but it was very designy, but it wasn't really talking about code enough for me. And then there was WebMonkey. Maybe you guys remember WebMonkey.
That's still, well, in some form, it's still around. Was that back. Related to Wired?
Yeah, it's back. But at one time, it was very vital. It was like a, you know. But, you know, I think the great thing about the web, if you don't like what you see, you make it yourself. Right.
Sure.
Right? If you're not, it's like punk rock. If you don't like the songs on the radio, learn to play an instrument and make your own band. So that was
A List Apart is like punk rock.
So not anymore.
Now there's like new things coming up that are like the new punk rock. A List Apart is the radio now.
A List Apart is like, it's like punk rock that you hear in a supermarket.
That's great. So yeah, speaking of, like, I liked how you, like, there was like topics of the day that came up on these things, or there was just like something in the air that would end up being talked about. And that, I like, that's how A List Apart goes. A lot of times when you publish two articles together, they're very related to each other because it just happens to like kind of feel like a hot topic these days.
Yeah,
which I think is neat.
Gotta give Rose and Sarah a lot of credit for, you know, finding and coaxing a lot of that content and sort of structuring it so that we can do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Those are like content acquisition people from you and editors.
Yeah. I know how to say her name and I'm going to mispronounce it now. Sarah Watcher Butcher is our editor in chief. Watcher Butcher.
Nice.
Sorry, editor.
We have that problem on this podcast too.
No stranger to hard glass names.
Yeah. Why is? What's wrong with these people?
Just Smith. Guys.
Is there something wrong with Smith? I want you to tell me what it is.
No, I like seeing people's full last name. We just got one, and I didn't even realize it until we just got a question from somebody that put their first name and then as their last name put, you couldn't pronounce it anyway. And I was like, oh, but I want to try.
That's why we have like Kurifier, right? That's why we have like that other name that you can call someone. But if you couldn't pronounce Jeremy Keith for some reason, you could just say, well, we've got a Dactio here on our show.
Everyone needs a pronounceable handle. I always
wondered how they do it for sports, you know, because there's like thousands and thousands of sports players. They all have, you know, well, they don't all have, but there's a lot of people with crazy names. I wonder if they have like some, like a website that's only for TV pundits where they can like click a button and it will pronounce it correctly for them.
Yeah. I'm sure that's true. Newscasters also, right?
Yeah. Or it's some like innate ability they have. They're just born with it. Anyway, where I was going with that, like that kind of topic in the air thing is there's one that's going on right now. And literally, I think, did you write this up today, Jeffrey? There's a new post on Zeldman.com. It's in defense of descendant selectors and ID elements, which is our response to kind of, well, you mentioned one specific article in the post, but kind of a feeling in there. There's honestly one that's very similar on CSSTricks.com about how, you know, like don't use IDs. Is kind of the overall thing, and Jeffrey's article is kind of like, I have a different opinion.
Yeah, Well, when I started advocating IDs and descendant selectors, it was because back in the day, the first people, not me, but many of the first people writing CSS would just write this absolute crap, right? Span class equal paragraph. Span class equal paragraph. There wasn't, it's not even like, that's not even a span element, guy.
Yeah.
It should be a div and it should be a paragraph, but they wouldn't. They'd be span class equal paragraph. And even like Basecamp was structured. I mean, there was lots of stuff that was structured really, really badly. And the idea that there was a, you know, some kind of semantic meaning to your markup and was kind of non-existent except the W3C, and no one was listening to them. So, and people hadn't really put together how simple it was to just, you know, if all the list items in your sidebar, right, are subnavs, you can just say, you know, UL list, list, list item, list item, list item, list item, and have a descendant selector class that says, you know, list items in the sidebar look a certain way.
Yeah, super clean.
And that's super clean as opposed to LI class equal, LI class equal, LI class equal. But that's what they weren't even using list items, right? I mean, they were using like spans with break tags, right? But so there was lots of stuff to clean up back in the day. And so, and when I wrote Designing with Web Standards, like a lot of people, I just call that stuff classism, classitis and not classism, that's a different thing. Classitis and divitis, right? I said, like,
yeah,
we've got
you
all
coined
this.
That?
Yeah, because it was an easy way to understand what was wrong with it. It was like this measles of markup, right? And it's like,
yeah.
let's clean that up and let's write simple structural markup and, you know, write lean, optimized CSS. So that's what people were doing. But over the last couple of years, and it really started, Nicole Sullivan, who's a friend of mine, and she's brilliant, but she has a very specific focus in her CSS work. She's a CSS guru, and her task is to, she gets hired by people like Facebook, right, where they've got a 3 gigabyte style sheet that was written by 500 people over the course of 5 years with nobody in charge. And what happens is things get way too, you know, people that use descendant selectors in that circumstance, they're like, oh, I've written this rule, but for some reason it's not coming out. Obviously, there's some other rule somewhere in this big, up this food chain. There's some other rule that's preventing my rule from working, and I don't know what it is. So I'll write a rule like that says HTML body div, you know, div yeah. pound.
So it's slightly more specific, and it wins the specificity.
It wins,
battle.
And so then the next person, you know, and it's basically like a bunch of people using important.
Yeah, this is like the battle of internal developers.
Right. So based on that situation, right, where you have lots of developers over time, not really necessarily communicating with each other, a big unmanageable style sheet, and people can't really tell, you know, which rules are, you know, they have a lot to deal with, and they don't know what's causing the problems. Nicole came up with some basically very good rules for that situation. One is, you know, class is preferable to ID and descendant selector in that situation. And, you know, I'm all in favor of that. The problem is, she came up with a really great name for it, object-oriented CSS. She's a great speaker. She popularized it. And people start taking it out of context and thinking this one solution to this specific problem is now a universal rule. My problem with our industry. Well, there's two. One is where everybody just goes, you know, higgledy piggledy, and nobody pays attention, nobody respects what they're doing. There's like bad developers do that, bad designers do that. We're not even talking about them. But among really good designers, right, or good developers who really care and want to do, we can become dogmatic. I mean, I did a redesign of my site, and it was a fixed width responsive design, and like the first 500 comments I got were like, haven't you heard of responsive design? It was like, yes, I have, but what if I had decided not to do that? Would I be crucified? It's like, just because
how dare you?
Just because, right? Just because this thing is cool and makes sense and is a good solution for in a lot of cases doesn't mean we all have to do the same thing. We all have to march in lockstep. My friend Sarah Parmenter says it's design, it's not religion. And design is about solutions, and different problems call for different solutions. I'm not saying that you must use descendant selectors and with ID, but I do think, you know, there's a good rationale for it. To me, it was what preceded the HTML5. We wouldn't even have these HTML5 elements if a lot of people hadn't been going, okay, div ID equal footer, div ID equal aside, div ID equal main content. And I think the people who put HTML5 together then looked and said, well, what are people doing? Oh, that's a good thing. Let's make those elements, right? So that practice led to an improvement, and to just discard it on the basis of this sort of religious belief that IDs are bad and descendant selectors are bad, it's the dogma that offends me more than, you know, if you have a good reason for not using that stuff, that's fine. I don't really care. But it's the dogma that bothers me. Anybody's dogma that bothers me.
That's good. We do have that. Where's the problem? I'm going to watch for that more. People that leave comments that are just like, "Yeah, you read that somewhere, didn't you?" And now you're just kind of.
Ugh. Yeah, we had Adam Greenfield, who's a futurist, wrote an article for Listapart. I don't know, 5 years ago, about it was called. He was working on a book called Everywhere, and the idea it was about ubiquitous computing, and you know, kind of the multi-device world we're in now. He was foreseeing that, but in his case, it was also like you'll go into the hotel and your wall will also be a computer interface, right? How will we do computing? How will we design interfaces when everything connects to the web and everything? So we're not there yet, but we're pretty close with these things in our pockets, right?
Yeah.
But anyway, Adam had written this great article, and the very first comment was, "Why should I listen to you when your site doesn't validate?" And it's like that's, I'm proud that, like, I'm proud that people got web standards and got excited and said, "Oh, I want to validate my code." But I think that's great. But validation isn't the be all and end all, and to judge someone for not validating. And I had a friend, I won't shame him by naming him.
Do it.
Really good. No, but
okay.
He wasn't the only one who did this, but he used to use JavaScript to obfuscate his embed tags so that his HTML 4 point whatever site would validate, even though he was using embed, which the W3C and its wisdom would never, everyone used embed for like 15 years, and the W3C never made it part of a standard. It was like, no. Object is, but well, object doesn't really work.
Yeah, just jumping through hoops just to get a green check mark instead of a red X.
That's right. That's not, and that seems silly. It's not a badge. It's to help you make sure that you're, you know, it's sort of a first line of defense. If someone says your site's not displaying properly or something's broken.
Exactly. It's
a helper, not a badge. And yeah, so that's my feeling about all of this stuff, right? If whatever system works for you, as long as you respect markup, you're not just writing, you know, span classical paragraph. But I don't want a bunch of people to hear or read arguments like the one I was reacting to, and then think ID is always bad, class is always good, and then start having another generation of classitis all over again. That would bother me, because I think we've come a long way. And, you know, there's reasons to use classes. There's reasons to use lots of stuff, but, you know, just be thoughtful. Just be thoughtful and not dogmatic.
That's the bottom line here. I was gonna. I have some thoughts on this too that I feel like are worth sharing. I might just do it as a blog post instead because I feel
talk. Do both.
Well, I can do a little bit in that I do generally feel like that I have an article. It's called A Line in the Sand on CSS Tricks, where I talk about not using IDs, because I do pretty much feel like and I hate, don't be dogmatic. Don't listen, people of Shop Talk Show, don't listen to me saying don't use IDs and then go off and say Chris Coyer said to not use IDs, because that's what I'm worried about and that's what Jeffrey's saying not to do. But I find in my day-to-day work on all the different projects that I work on that because I drew a line in the sand and I said I'm not using IDs anymore, it has helped me and it's helped my work because of this kind of lighter touch with, and the IDs are so infinitely more specific than classes that it leads to not necessarily teams battling each other, but even me battling myself. It comes up pretty regularly. So It has helped my work.
Tim Murta, who I work with, has gone away from using IDEs also, and he has like a really good rationale, probably very similar to your A Line in the Sand, a story about meaty chili and using glasses.
Yeah.
Which I think...
Yeah, it's about a vegetarian that I knew who said, it's not about that I don't eat meaty chili today. It's about that if I never eat meaty chili, it'll change my life, kind of thing.
Wow. Yeah. Now I have to read this. I see, and then I can recant everything. But no, I think what you're saying makes sense.
Yeah. But yeah, again, dogma.
I think, like, even aside from the CSS Wizardry article, I totally agree, Jeffrey. Like, our industry deals a lot with, we accept this idea, and then we're like, oh, this is, you know, the best thing, you know. And so when somebody launches a website, we just say, fail, it's not responsive. And that's, that dogma is terrible for the web design industry. And, it sort of makes us look like Fox News in a sense, and no offense if you listen or watch Fox News, but it just puts us in this like hyper, like, this is dumb because of this reason I accept, you know.
While guys like Ethan Marcotte would be the first guy to say, hey, this is just a tool in our toolbox of making good decisions.
Yes, exactly. We do have kind of that Animal Farm, two legs bad, four legs good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, should we jump into some questions here? That's kind of the meat and potatoes of the show.
We have a pile of them here, a number of them addressed directly to Jeffrey.
The first one comes from listener Kartik Vadlapatla. I think I got that one, Kartik.
Oh, you're good.
I messed it up the first time he wrote in. But anyway, he has a question for you, Jeffrey. I'm a web designer from India where even knowing a drafted Dribbble user is a luxury. The local design community is completely inactive. What advice would you give to a young, up-and-coming web designer like me to get better at design? You got any tips for... I'm sure you've come across people, you know, remote people.
First of all,
people.
So there's a few things. First of all, the web is international, and it sounds like... I mean, if you're listening to this show, right, and... you're reading the blog that from this show, or you're reading other content. It really doesn't matter whether the content's written in India or England or Africa. It's wherever the good content is, wherever people are talking, that's your community. So don't feel so alone. Like, make friends on Twitter. Keep the Twitter, keep like Twitterific or something open in the background, assuming that you have bandwidth and can do that. Or, just feel connected to the world. It's really important to feel connected to the world. I started web design in total isolation, right? Well, the first site I did with two friends. And then afterwards, I worked alone for years in my apartment. Well, not for years and years, but years and years, but for some years in my apartment. And, there were those newsletters, right? There was those mailing lists. Mm-hmm. Later, there was reading something on the web. And once we got the ability to post comments, that was great. So I think wherever you are, by writing and by posting thoughtful comments on other people's writing, and by what you retweet, if you're thoughtful about what you retweet and other people see value in it. That's one thing, right? So so the whole world is your community. The next thing is there's a lot of people doing remote work in India for British companies, American companies and whatnot. And if, I'm sure that some of those people would like to get together. Why not try to get a meetup started in your city? Just say, people interested in front-end design, we're going to meet at this place, and have snacks, drinks, whatever. Give it a try. There are some meetup organizations and meetup websites, there you may find that there's already a local branch of something, like a web standards group in your area. See if that's true. If not,
kind of saying community is pretty vital to getting better at design.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot you can do by yourself. And then, you know, what did he say about Dribbble again? That it was a luxury? Just
kind of a luxury to even know somebody who's a member of Dribbble, which I thought was kind of a funny detail.
If he sends me an email, I will send him a Dribbble invitation. And he can start posting his stuff on Dribbble and getting feedback. And I think that will be helpful.
Right.
Feedback is the most important thing. Like, you can work alone, but you have to communicate. Community is everything. I hope that helps. So, and do say the gentleman's name again.
Kartik.
Kartik, please send me an email. Easy peasy, and I'll send you that Dribbble.
Nice. We have one here from Chris. You got to do this, Dave.
Chris Marquez.
Oh, sorry. That was easy. I get it. This is interesting. It's kind of a history one, it's about Allistapart. Is it safe to say that Allistapart.com was one of the first sites to use floats for CSS layout? He wants to know more detail about that because there's an article still on Allistapart, From Table Hacks to CSS Layout, A Web Designer's Journey, in which it says in there that you had some help doing it. I don't even know what year this is from. Probably way back. And then you list the help as being anonymous. And then later in your book, Designing with Web Standards, you kind of out those people as being Todd Farner and Tantik Celik.
Okay, so these guys, those two people are such unsung heroes. I mean, those two gentlemen and maybe one or two other people, we'd still be like using sticks and stones and Flash to do everything. Tantik created the first standards-compliant browser rendering engine, IE5 Macintosh, for which he was punished. They sent him to work on TV because it made IE Windows, which had a huge market share, look bad. That IE5 Macintosh, which had a tiny market share, was suddenly, and it was certainly wasn't perfect. You know, 2 years later, people were grumbling about it, but initially, it was the first, and he came up with one of the first hacks that basically compensated for the box model hack, which basically compensated for the fact that IE in Windows had a much more logical, much more pleasing, but technically incorrect box model, right? And and that, so you could use CSS anyway. And Todd was the guy, he was trying to get a standard font size across browsers and devices. He did a lot for type. And just when we started to be on the verge of, this web standards movement really gaining ground, he said, I'm done. And he now makes bicycles and sells bicycles somewhere. I don't even know where, like Montana. I'm not sure where he is.
Really? Just kind of pieced out of the community.
Yeah, he pieced out of the community. Nice.
He rage quit.
He peaced out. He peaced out. But in the book, especially in the first edition, I talk a lot about those guys because they really are heroes. But anyway, basically at that time I had, oh my gosh, it was pretty terrible. It was a liquid layout for dogmatic political reasons and a liquid layout, but I used I made a header image for every article, and that was of a fixed width, so you can imagine the fun. Anyway, and trying to make that look good. But
the edges have to fade out.
We decided that the list apart should do its layout in pure CSS, whereas before I was using CSS for type. I mean, in 1998, I was using CSS for type, but not much else. And, there were so many problems in the browsers then, and like a table layout, and it was pretty. It was still a loose table layout. It wasn't like I wasn't piecing thousands of images together to make a fake page. I asked their help because it took three of us to figure out how to do it. right? And now, you know, because float, it's not like the framers of CSS said, now, of course, there'll be multiple columns and you'll use float as a hack. They hadn't envisioned multiple columns, I guess. Or maybe they had a column. Eric Meyer would be a great guest to talk about this stuff because he's been a part of the history of CSS since forever. And maybe there was a column idea and it got shelved at the last minute when, you know, so they could get CSS 1 out the door. I'm not sure, but so there wasn't really any, and floats are a terrible hack. And then floats in browsers like Netscape 4 and IE 4, you can, again, imagine the fun. So they were things that, well, we did it, but it was like crazy. So things like, well, since we had the accurate box model, if this column was if the sidebar was a certain width, I don't know, we didn't have media queries back then. There's a lot of things you couldn't do. You wanted to keep relationships between these two columns, size relationships, in a liquid layout where the type couldn't get bigger, the image couldn't get bigger. It was sort of a very, very crude early attempt to do what we now, you know, thanks to responsive design and responsive images and everything else, now we're finally able to do these things. But
it's funny though, it's a lot. We've come a long way, but I still lean on floats for layout. You know,
yeah, you have to.
Yeah, hopefully those days are ending.
Well, at first, I used to do CSS layouts with fixed position. Everything was absolute position.
Yeah.
So, wow, that was crazy, and it always worked so well on my Mac. Right, I'd be like, this looks so good on my computer.
Yeah.
Oh, the trouble is your monitor has a different resolution than mine. Yeah, that's no good. It's not going to work for you. I mean, I didn't do that, but you'd start, you know, and things seemed much more expensive back then, and especially if you worked alone. So it's not like I was sitting at home with 15 computers that I could check my work on. It really wasn't. So that was, and that's to the gentleman who wrote in earlier, Cleek. That's another reason you need community, because maybe you can't afford 5 different phones, but maybe if you get 5 friends, you can check your work, you know, you can form a little group together and check your work on phones and whatnot. We didn't have phones in the equation back then, you know, but it seemed hard enough even so.
Yeah.
It never seems to get easier, does it, guys?
Well, no, it really doesn't. Plenty to say about that, but some things do, you know, like I'm not worried about whether I can or cannot do something in CSS anymore, but there's always like new things to worry about.
It's much more complicated now.
Yeah. Yeah. There's better resources for learning now. Speaking of which,
segue,
we have one for sponsoring the show recently. Now it's just lynda.com, who've been around forever. Even Jeffrey mentioned, what's her last name? Lynda's her first
Lynda
name.
Weinman.
Lynda Weinman. I have the right Lynda, right?
She was Matt Groening's girlfriend in college. Matt Groening, who created
like Simpsons.
Yes.
What?
And before that, when you guys were babies, or maybe not even born yet, he, in the late 80s and early 90s, he had a comic called Life in Hell in the early 90s before The Simpsons.
I remember.
And she's one of the characters. You know that rabbit with the big glasses?
Yeah.
The rabbit girl? That's her.
No way.
I just found this out. She was at a friend's wedding. I see her like every 10 years. And... she's awesome. She's such an amazing human being. But yeah,
well,
she
started a good company, you know. So that's a good thing. I did one. It's almost 2 years ago now. I flew out to, they have like offices and somewhere north of LA in a cute little town, and I did a video series on building themes with WordPress, which is still kind of where I tell people to go. And they asked me how to get started working with WordPress as a designer and building themes and stuff. So that's on lynda.com. There's 77,000 other videos on lynda.com. So she's, you know, put some content together. If you go to lynda.com/shoptalk, you get your first week for free, and then it starts at $25 a month and you get access to all 77,000 of those. And certainly you can learn web design and programming there. But as you guys are listening to this podcast, you can learn web design and programming. There's lots of resources for that. But they also have photography, business lessons, stuff for audio and video, 3D animation, and regular animation, all that type of stuff. So Linda has covers a wider swath than just web design stuff. But they certainly have that too. You know, it works on your iPad, stuff like that. So it's a nice little organization. So thanks for sponsoring lynda.com. Let's do one more, and then we got to wrap things up.
Yeah, we got to send Jeffrey off. This one's from Seb Green. He writes in, and he says, Jeffrey has been doing things on the web since the early days. We are currently all going on about responsive web design, semantics, and all the latest trends, etc. But he must have seen so many more important changes that have happened in the industry's history. And what is the one thing that stands out to you, Jeffrey, as the biggest change you've had to deal with in your career?
I think the invention of fire.
Fire hot.
Without that, I mean, before that, we would just, you know, fling the animals against rocks and try to cook them that way, and it didn't really work. And rub them against our bodies, that's a whole area I don't
for
you know what, we're not going to get into that. Seb Green, great question. I think the transition from tables to standards, from tables and Flash to standards, was the biggest thing, and now what we're going through is another biggest thing. But I was one of the people who was fortunate enough to be there early on, and I was doing, you know, non-semantic markup and using HTML as a design tool in 1995. So when we started the Web Standards Project, Steve Champion, Dory Smith, Jeff Bean, a lot of people, a lot of really brilliant people, when we started the Web Standards Project at first it was just, we want to be able to design for all these browsers with one set of code. And that's all we really wanted. It wasn't like, we think that the W3C has a brilliant idea and that by implication, so, you know, where it would all lead, we didn't know. But moving from, you know, really junk markup to semantic, lean, structural HTML and taking the layout out of the HTML and putting it in CSS and not writing inline JavaScript, but, you know, separating the JavaScript out too, separating the behavior layer, that was a huge, huge change for everybody who, every old web designer and developer like me, everybody who'd been doing it for 5 years or so, it was huge to change, to throw out everything we knew. And for me, still, I couldn't write a table layout now, probably, but it's still, CSS is not second nature to me. It's still weird because, you know, I guess it's like if you grew up before television and then you were 40 years old when television was invented, TV would always be something a little bit weird in your life. It's kind of like you might like it, but it would still be a little funny and new in some weird way. The thing that we pushed for and pioneered is a little strange to us, as opposed to, like, there's a lot of designer developers in their 20s and 30s who just grew up with it, don't know any other way to code, which is cool. So I think that was the huge and just the big struggle to get browsers to support it, and then the big struggle to get designers and developers to take it seriously. And I always give a shout out to Dave Shea's CSS Zen Garden, because but, you know, pictures speak louder than words. I think when people, a lot of designers, Mike Pick, who I work with now, when they saw CSS Zen Garden, they were like, oh, this is cool. Suddenly that stuff seemed really cool. So I think that was a huge change. And now I think we're going through another one with multi-device, content first, design as this sort of fluid thing instead of this fixed thing, design as a layer, as like design as layers of enhancement, you know.
Yeah. You think this might be just as big?
I think so. I think it is. Yeah. Well, because Luke Wroblewski says that mobile is actually a different mass medium from the web, that the web was, you know, the fastest growing mass medium since television, much faster than television, but mobile's growing even faster. I don't know if it's a separate thing. In a way, it's just a way of accessing the web. Without the web, what is mobile? You know, so I'm not sure I agree 100% with Luke, but I do think it's huge. It's a sea change. So what we're going through now, really big, and the movement from the movement to web standards, really big. You know, ask a content strategist and they'll tell you content strategy is the big, you know, the acceptance mm-hmm. of content strategy is the big thing. But
sure.
Know.
Ask a roofer and he's like, shingles, huge.
I want to say that episode of the Big Web Show that Luke was on back, you know, episode 8 or something long time ago, that was pretty monumental. I still remember where I was listening to, like, you know, Luke kind of just breaking down the facts of mobile is now the default, or it will be in the next year. And, you know, sure enough, it more mobile devices are sold than PCs now. So that was, it's a killer episode. If listeners haven't listened to it, go back and listen to that one. Start there.
Thank you very, very much. As the co-founder of In a Better Part with Eric Meyer, I've had the amazing benefit and advantage of, like we put on 7 shows last year, and Luke Wablewski was at every one of them, and he gave a workshop at almost every one of them. So I've basically seen him perform, you know, speaking live for, like, I don't know, 40 or 50 hours and in a year. And that's life-changing. That's the biggest thing. That's the biggest thing, hearing Luke. No, but I mean, it really drives home because he's great. Like you say, he's great with facts and figures. It's not like, I feel in my heart that mobile's important. No, it's like, here, you know, here's what the president of Google said, and here's the chart showing, and here's what they predicted, and here's why it's actually faster. And, you know, it's stuff you could take to your boss. It's stuff you could take to your boss. You don't have to be an evangelist. You could take it to your boss, and it's duh. Your boss would look at it and go, oh. And I think people are getting that. I think, I'll tell you, people are really getting responsive and mobile in a way that they didn't. It seemed like it took 10 years for web standards to be accepted, and it seems like responsive and mobile are just bang, they're getting it. I don't know why.
That's a nice sentiment to end with, I think. We're better people now.
Maybe that's it.
Okay, good. So we gotta wrap things up here. Do you have the final thing, Dave?
Should yeah, Jeffrey. I guess, you know, thanks so much for coming on the show. We really appreciate it. Thanks everyone for listening live. I think we broke the chat room, so we'll have to send out some apology emails. Cool. But Jeffrey, before you go, just kind of a recap. How can people follow you if they're strangely not doing that, or they're
don't. Okay, don't forget Blue Beanie Day on November 30th in support of web standards.
That's coming up.
It is November 30th, so like around the corner. Wear your blue hat to support web standards, the 6th annual International Blue Beanie Day. You can follow me at Zeldman.com, predictably enough, and at Zeldman on Twitter. Those are the two easiest ways, at Zeldman on Twitter, and Zeldman.com, and of course alistapart.com.
And if you don't already have the rainbow of books at A Book Apart, go buy all those.
Why, thank you.
Awesome. Well, Jeffrey, we know you got to get going, so we'll let you go. Thanks so much,
Dave and Chris. You run a great show, and it was a real honor and pleasure to be here. Thank you very much, and happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Talk to you again soon. Well, before we wrap up here, folks, I want to mention one more sponsor that we have here, a longtime sponsor, of course, of the Shop Talk Show. You know I'm talking about Environments for Humans. Environmentsforhumans.com is kind of like their home base, but they always say, don't send people there. Send them to the actual individual URLs for the conferences they do. And I know there was even a tweet on Twitter the other day. There's like, I can't wait till the Chris and Dave's Hawaii trip is older so they can stop talking about it because they couldn't make it. And they were just jealous, so I understand. that's In Control in Hawaii. But In Control is home base is in Orlando.
Mm-hmm.
That's where it's going on. So the 2013 In Control, which you can visit in your web browser at 2013.incontrolconference. And I've been to more of them in Orlando. This is Hawaii thing is new. This their venue in Orlando is fabulous. The conference in Orlando is fabulous. I like the city of Orlando. I like hanging out. I like the people there. Anyway, 2013, it's going to be back in Orlando. Carl Smith, both me and Dave are going to be there. Megan Fisher, Zoe Gillenwater, Brad Frost, David McFarlane, people that you recognize from being on the Shop Talk show, all going to be at In Control Orlando. Yeah, it's going to be awesome. It's going to be awesome. You should come to it. Let's see. If you use the discount code SHOPTALKSHOW, all caps, I'm not sure if it matters or not, but that's how he gave it to us. It's good for $100 off. So it's February. So February 17th through 19th, literally in Orlando. You can save by the fact that it's an early bird ticket and save $100 for Shop Talk Show. Make it a very affordable conference to go to. Anyway.
Yeah, this should be something you tell your boss, like, hey, I have to go to one conference this year, and this one is it, because this one looks awesome. There's on that speakers list, it's like, I will listen to all of these people for at least an hour. Like, this is awesome. So
we're going to wish there was more days to this thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, thanks for sponsoring In Control Conference. I hope to see some of you there. This is one of literally my favorite ones of all time. I think it's just a very high quality conference.
And thanks everyone. Yeah, thanks again. And then thanks everyone for listening. We really appreciate it. Follow at Shop Talk Show on Twitter. Rate us up in iTunes. You know the drill. Also, somebody wrote in and said, hey, can you be on Stitcher app? Because I would love that. And we filled out an application, and I'm looking at an email right this very minute that says, you made it, dude. So we're in Stitcher app. So
what?
If that's your thing, you like Stitcher. It's a pretty cool podcasting app. So yeah, so we're in there too now. Ta-da. All right. Well, cool. Chris, you got anything else?
Shoptalkshow.com.